some of these unfortunate men made various confessions of treasonable designs, but, such confessions were easily got, under torture and the fear of fire, and are very little to be trusted. To finish the sad story of Sir John Oldcastle at once, I may mention that he escaped into Wales, and remained there safely, for 4 years. When discovered by Lord Powys, it is very doubtful if he would have been taken alive, ere so great was the old soldier at EMS bravery, if a miserable old woman had not come behind him and broken his legs with a stool. He was carried to London in a horse litter, was fastened by an iron chain to a gibbet, and so roasted to death. To make the state of France as plain as I can in a few words, I should tell you that the Duke of Orleans, and the Duke of Burgundy, commonly called A. John without fear, A.T.M. had a grand reconciliation of their quarrel in the last train, and had appeared to be quite in a heavenly state of mind. Immediately after which, on a Sunday, in the public streets of Paris, the Duke of Orleans was murdered by a party of 20 men, set on by the Duke of Burgundy, according to his own deliberate confession. The widow of King Richard had been married in France to the eldest son of the Duke of Orleans. The poor mad king was quite powerless to help her, and the Duke of Burgundy became the real master of France. Isabella dying, her husband, Duke of Orleans since the death of his father, married the daughter of the Count of Armagnac, who, being a much abler man than his young son-in-law, headed his party, thence called after him Armagnacs. Thus, France was now in this terrible condition, that it had in it the party of the King Otm's son, the Dauphin Louis, the party of the Duke of Burgundy, who was the father of the Dauphin Otm's used wife, and the party of the Armagnacs, all hating each other, all fighting together, all composed of the most depraved nobles that the earth has ever known, and all tearing unhappy France to pieces. The late king had watched these dissensions from England, sensible, like the French people, that no enemy of France could injure her more than her own nobility. The present king now advanced a claim to the French throne, his demand being, of course, refused. He reduced his proposal to a certain large amount of French territory, and to demanding the French princess, Catherine, in marriage, with a fortune of 2 millions of golden crowns. He was offered less territory and fewer crowns, and no princess, but he called his ambassadors home and prepared for war. Then, he proposed to take the princess with 1 million of crowns. The French court replied that he should have the princess with 200,000 crowns less. He said this would not do, he had never seen the princess in his life, and assembled his army at Southampton. There was a short plot at home just at that time, for deposing him, and making the Earl of March king, but the conspirators were all speedily condemned and executed, and the king embarked for France. It is dreadful to observe how long a bad example will be followed, but, it is encouraging to know that a good example is never thrown away. The King Otm's first act on disembarking at the mouth of the River Seine, 3 miles from Harfleur, was to imitate his father, and to proclaim his solemn orders that the lives and property of the peaceable inhabitants should be respected on pain of death. It is agreed by French writers, to his lasting renown, that even while his soldiers were suffering the greatest distress from want of food, these commands were rigidly obeyed. With an army in all of 30,000 men, he besieged the town of Harfleur both by sea and land for 5 weeks, at the end of which time the town surrendered, and the inhabitants were allowed to depart with only 5 pence each, and a part of their clothes. All the rest of their possessions was divided amongst the English army. But, that army suffered so much, in spite of its successes, from disease and privation, that it was already reduced one half. Still, the king was determined not to retire until he had struck a greater blow. Therefore, against the advice of all his counselors, he moved on with his little force towards Calais. When he came up to the River Somme he was unable to cross, in consequence of the fort being fortified, and, as the English moved up the left bank of the river looking for a crossing, the French, who had broken all the bridges, moved up the right bank, watching them, and waiting to attack them when they should try to pass it. At last the English found a crossing and got safely over. the French held a council of war at Rouen, resolved to give the English battle, and sent heralds to King Henry to know by which road he was going. "A by the road that will take me straight to Calais." "ATM," said the king, and sent them away with a present of 100 crowns. The English moved on, until they beheld the French, and then the king gave orders to form in line of battle. The French not coming on, the army broke up after remaining in battle array till night, and got good rest and refreshment at a neighboring village. The French were now all lying in another village, through which they knew the English must pass. They were resolved that the English should begin the battle. The English had no means of retreat, if their king had any such intention, and so the two armies passed the night, close together. To understand these armies well, you must bear in mind that the immense French army had, among its notable persons, almost the whole of that wicked nobility, whose debauchery had made France a desert, and so besotted were they by pride, and by contempt for the common people, that they had scarcely any bowmen, if indeed they had any at all, in their whole enormous number, which, compared with the English army, was at least a 6-to-1. For these proud fools had said that the bow was not a fit weapon for knightly hands, and that France must be defended by gentlemen only. We shall see, presently, what hand the gentlemen made of it. Now, on the English side, among the little force, there was a good proportion of men who were not gentlemen by any means, but who were good stout archers for all that. Among them, in the morning having slept little at night, while the French were carousing and making sure of Victoria, the king rode, on a grey horse, wearing on his head a helmet of shining steel, surmounted by a crown of gold, sparkling with precious stones, and bearing over his armour, embroidered together, the arms of England and the arms of France. The archers looked at the shining helmet and the crown of gold and the sparkling jewels, and admired them all, but, what they admired most was the king's cheerful face, and his bright blue eye, as he told them that, for himself, he had made up his mind to conquer the or to die the, and that England should never have a ransom to pay for him. There was one brave knight who chanced to say that he wished some of the many gallant gentlemen and good soldiers, who were then idle at home in England, were there to increase their numbers. But the king told him that, for his part, he did not wish for one more man. "Are the fewer we have, ATM," said he, "are the greater will be the honour we shall win." ATM His men, being now all in good heart, were refreshed with bread and wine, and heard prayers, and waited quietly for the French. The king waited for the French, because they were drawn up 30 deep, the little English force was only 3 deep, on very difficult and heavy ground, and he knew that when they moved, there must be confusion among them. As they did not move, he sent off 2 parties, a one to lie concealed in a wood on the left of the French, the other, to set fire to some houses behind the French after the battle should be begun. This was scarcely done, when 3 of the proud French gentlemen, who were to defend their country without any help from the base peasants, came riding out, calling upon the English to surrender. The king warned those gentlemen himself to retire with all speed if they cared for their lives, and ordered the English banners to advance. Upon that, Sir Thomas Erpingham, a great English general, who commanded the archers, threw his truncheon into the air, joyfully, and all the English men, kneeling down upon the ground and biting it as if they took possession of the country, rose up with a great shout and fell upon the French. Every archer was furnished with a great stake tipped with iron, and his orders were, to thrust this stake into the ground, to discharge his arrow, and then to fall back, when the French horsemen came on. As the haughty French gentlemen, who were to break the English archers and utterly destroy them with their knightly lances, came riding up, they were received with such a blinding storm of arrows, that they broke and turned. Horses and men rolled over one another, and the confusion was terrific. Those who rallied and charged the archers got among the stakes on slippery and boggy ground, and were so bewildered that the English archer, sir, who wore no armour, and even took off their leathern coats to be more active, ere cut them to pieces, root and branch. Only 3 French horsemen got within the stakes, and those were instantly dispatched. All this time the dense French army, being in armor, were sinking knee-deep into the mire, while the light English archers, half-naked, were as fresh and active as if they were fighting on a marble floor. But now, the second division of the French coming to the relief of the first, closed up in a firm mass, the English, headed by the king, attacked them, and the deadliest part of the battle began. The King Otiam's brother, the Duke of Clarence, was struck down, and numbers of the French surrounded him. But, King Henry, standing over the body, fought like a lion until they were beaten off. Presently, came up a band of 18 French knights, bearing the banner of a certain French lord, who had sworn to kill or take the English king. One of them struck him such a blow with a battle axe that he reeled and fell upon his knees, but, his faithful men, immediately closing round him, killed every one of those 18 knights, and so that French lord never kept his oath. The French Duke of Alenay tilde section on, seeing this, made a desperate charge, and cut his way close up to the royal standard of England. He beat down the Duke of York, who was standing near it, and, when the king came to his rescue, struck off a piece of the crown he wore. But, he never struck another blow in this world, for, even as he was in the act of saying who he was, and that he surrendered to the king, and even as the king stretched out his hand to give him a safe and honorable acceptance of the offer, he fell dead, pierced by innumerable wounds. The death of this nobleman decided the battle. The third division of the French army, which had never struck a blow yet, and which was, in itself, more than double the whole English power, broke and fled. At this time of the fight, the English, who as yet had made no prisoners, began to take them in immense numbers, and were still occupied in doing so, or in killing those who would not surrender, when a great noise arose in the rear of the French as their flying banners were seen to stop, and King Henry, supposing a great reinforcement to have arrived, gave orders that all the prisoners should be put to death. As soon, however, as it was found that the noise was only occasioned by a body of plundering peasants, the terrible massacre was stopped. Then King Henry called to him the French herald, and asked him to whom the victory belonged. The herald replied, "A to the King of England. Atm. A we have not made this havoc and slaughter." "Atm," said the king, "it is the wrath of heaven on the sins of France." "What is the name of that castle yonder?" "Atm," the herald answered him, "A my lord, it is the castle of Azincourt." "Atm," said the king, "A from henceforth this battle shall be known to posterity, by the name of the Battle of Azincourt." "Atm," our English historians have made it Agincourt, but, under that name, it will ever be famous in English annals. The loss upon the French side was enormous. 3 dukes were killed, 2 more were taken prisoners, 7 counts were killed, 3 more were taken prisoners, and 10,000 knights and gentlemen were slain upon the field. The English loss amounted to 1,600 men, among whom were the Duke of York and the Earl of Suffolk. War is a dreadful thing, and it is appalling to know how the English were obliged, next morning, to kill those prisoners mortally wounded, who yet writhed in agony upon the ground, how the dead upon the French side were stripped by their own countrymen and countrywomen, and afterwards buried in great pits, how the dead upon the English side were piled up in a great barn, and how their bodies and the barn were all burned together. It is in such things, and in many more much too horrible to relate, that the real desolation and wickedness of war consist. Nothing can make war otherwise than horrible. But the dark side of it was little thought of and soon forgotten, and it cast no shade of trouble on the English people, except on those who had lost friends or relations in the fight. They welcomed their king home with shouts of rejoicing, and plunged into the water to bear him ashore on their shoulders, and flocked out in crowds to welcome him in every town through which he passed, and hung rich carpets and tapestries out of the windows, and strewed the streets with flowers, and made the fountains run with wine, as the great field of Agincourt had run with blood. Second part, that proud and wicked French nobility who dragged their country to destruction, and who were every day and every year regarded with deeper hatred and detestation in the hearts of the French people, learnt nothing, even from the defeat of Agincourt. So far from uniting against the common enemy, They became, among themselves, more violent, more bloody, and more falsy if that were possibly than they had been before. The Count of Armagnac persuaded the French king to plunder of her treasures Queen Isabella of Bavaria, and to make her a prisoner. She, who had hitherto been the bitter enemy of the Duke of Burgundy, proposed to join him, in revenge. He carried her off to Troyes, where she proclaimed herself regent of France, and made him her lieutenant. The Armagnac party were at that time possessed of Paris, but, one of the gates of the city being secretly opened on a certain night to a party of the Duke Etienne's men, they got into Paris, threw into the prisons all the Armagnacs upon whom they could lay their hands, and, a few nights afterwards, with the aid of a furious mob of 60,000 people, broke the prisons open, and killed them all. The former Dauphin was now dead, and the King Etienne's third son bore the title. Him, in the height of this murderous scene, a French knight hurried out of bed, wrapped in a sheet, and bore away to Poitiers. So, when the revengeful Isabella and the Duke of Burgundy entered Paris in triumph after the slaughter of their enemies, the Dauphin was proclaimed at Poitiers as the real regent. King Henry had not been idle since his victory of Agincourt, but had repulsed a brave attempt of the French to recover Harfleur, had gradually conquered a great part of Normandy, and, at this crisis of affairs, took the important town of Rouen, after a siege of half a year. This great loss so alarmed the French, that the Duke of Burgundy proposed that a meeting to treat of peace should be held between the French and the English kings in a plain by the River Seine. On the appointed day, King Henry appeared there, with his two brothers, Clarence and Gloucester, and 1,000 men. The unfortunate French king, being more mad than usual that day, could not come, but the queen came, and with her the Princess Catherine, who was a very lovely creature, and who made a real impression on King Henry, now that he saw her for the first time. This was the most important circumstance that rose out of the meeting. As if it were impossible for a French nobleman of that time to be true to his word of honor in anything, Henry discovered that the Duke of Burgundy was, at that very moment, in secret treaty with the Dauphin, and he therefore abandoned the negotiation. The Duke of Burgundy and the Dauphin, each of whom with the best reason distrusted the other as a noble ruffian surrounded by a party of noble ruffians, were rather at a loss how to proceed after this, but, at length they agreed to meet, on the bridge over the river Yonne, where it was arranged that there should be two strong gates put up, with an empty space between them, and that the Duke of Burgundy should come into that space by one gate, with 10 men only, and that the Dauphin should come into that space by the other gate, also with 10 men, and no more. So far the Dauphin kept his word, but no farther. When the Duke of Burgundy was on his knee before him in the act of speaking, one of the Dauphin Etienne's noble ruffians cut the said Duke down with a small axe, and others speedily finished him. It was in vain for the Dauphin to pretend that this base murder was not done with his consent, it was too bad, even for France, and caused a general horror. The Duke Etienne's heir hastened to make a treaty with King Henry, and the French queen engaged that her husband should consent to it, whatever it was. Henry made peace, on condition of receiving the Princess Catherine in marriage, and being made regent of France during the rest of the King Etienne's lifetime, and succeeding to the French crown at his death. He was soon married to the beautiful princess, and took her proudly home to England, where she was crowned with great honor and glory. This peace was called the Perpetual Peace. We shall soon see how long it lasted. It gave great satisfaction to the French people, although they were so poor and miserable, that, at the time of the celebration of the royal marriage, numbers of them were dying with starvation, on the dunghills in the streets of Paris. There was some resistance on the part of the Dauphin in some few parts of France, but King Henry beat it all down. And now, with his great possessions in France secured, and his beautiful wife to cheer him, and a son born to give him greater happiness, all appeared bright before him. But, in the fullness of his triumph and the height of his power, death came upon him, and his day was done. When he fell ill at Vincennes, and found that he could not recover, he was very calm and quiet, and spoke serenely to those who wept around his bed. His wife and child, he said. He left to the loving care of his brother the Duke of Bedford, and his other faithful nobles. He gave them his advice that England should establish a friendship with the new Duke of Burgundy, and offer him the regency of France, that it should not set free the royal princes who had been taken at Agincourt, and that, whatever quarrel might arise with France, England should never make peace without holding Normandy. Then, he laid down his head, and asked the attendant priests to chant the penitential psalms, amid which solemn sounds, on the 31st of August, 1422, in only the 34th year of his age and the 10th of his reign, King Henry V passed away. Slowly and mournfully they carried his embalmed body in a procession of great state to Paris, and thence to Rouen where his queen was, from whom the sad intelligence of his death was concealed until he had been dead some days. Thence, lying on a bed of crimson and gold, with a golden crown upon the head, and a golden ball and scepter lying in the nerveless hands, they carried it to Calais, with such a great retinue as seemed to dye the road black. The King of Scotland acted as chief mourner, all the royal household followed. The knights wore black armour and black plumes of feathers, crowds of men bore torches, making the night as light as day, and the widowed princess followed last of all. At Calais there was a fleet of ships to bring the funeral host to Dover. And so, by way of London Bridge, where the service for the dead was chanted as it passed along, they brought the body to Westminster Abbey, and they buried it with great respect. Chapter XIX England under Henry VI Part the First. It had been the wish of the late king, that while his infant son King Henry VI, at this time only 9 months old, was under age, the Duke of Gloucester should be appointed regent. The English Parliament, however, preferred to appoint a council of regency, with the Duke of Bedford at its head, to be represented, in his absence only, by the Duke of Gloucester. The Parliament would seem to have been wise in this, for Gloucester soon showed himself to be ambitious and troublesome, and, in the gratification of his own personal schemes, gave dangerous offence to the Duke of Burgundy, which was with difficulty adjusted. As that Duke declined the regency of France, it was bestowed by the poor French king upon the Duke of Bedford. But, the French king dying within 2 months, the Dauphin instantly asserted his claim to the French throne, and was actually crowned under the title of Charles VII. The Duke of Bedford, to be a match for him, entered into a friendly league with the Dukes of Burgundy and Brittany, and gave them his two sisters in marriage. War with France was immediately renewed, and the perpetual peace came to an untimely end. In the first campaign, the English, aided by this alliance, were speedily successful. As Scotland, however, had sent the French 5,000 men, and might send more, or attack the north of England while England was busy with France, it was considered that it would be a good thing to offer the Scottish king, James, who had been so long imprisoned, his liberty, on his paying £40,000 for his board and lodging during 19 years, and engaging to forbid his subjects from serving under the flag of France. It is pleasant to know, not only that the amiable captive at last regained his freedom upon these terms, but, that he married a noble English lady, with whom he had been long in love, and became an excellent king. I am afraid we have met with some kings in this history, and shall meet with some more, who would have been very much the better, and would have left the world much happier, if they had been imprisoned 19 years too. In the second campaign, the English gained a considerable victory at Verneuil, in a battle which was chiefly remarkable, otherwise, for their resorting to the odd expedient of tying their baggage horses together by the heads and tails, and jumbling them up with the baggage, so as to convert them into a sort of live fortification which was found useful to the troops, but which I should think was not agreeable to the horses. For 3 years afterwards very little was done, owing to both sides being too poor for war, which is a very expensive entertainment, but, a council was then held in Paris, in which it was decided to lay siege to the town of Orleans, which was a place of great importance to the Dauphin et Ms cause. An English army of 10,000 men was dispatched on this service, under the command of the Earl of Salisbury, a general of fame. he being unfortunately killed early in the siege, the Earl of Suffolk took his place, under whom, reinforced by Sir John Falstaff, who brought up 400 wagons laden with salt herrings and other provisions for the troops, and, beating off the French who tried to intercept him, came victorious out of a hot skirmish, which was afterwards called in jest the Battle of the Herrings. The town of Orleans was so completely hemmed in, that the besieged proposed to yield it up to their countryman the Duke of Burgundy. The English general, however, replied that his English men had won it, so far, by their blood and valour, and that his English men must have it. There seemed to be no hope for the town, or for the Dauphin, who was so dismayed that he even thought of flying to Scotland or to Spain, when a peasant girl rose up and changed the whole state of affairs. The story of this peasant girl I have now to tell. Part the second, the story of Joan of Arc. In a remote village among some wild hills in the province of Lorraine, there lived a countryman whose name was Jacques de Marc. He had a daughter, Joan of Arc, who was at this time in her 20th year. She had been a solitary girl from her childhood. She had often tended sheep and cattle for whole days where no human figure was seen or human voice heard, and she had often knelt, for hours together, in the gloomy, empty, little village chapel, looking up at the altar and at the dim lamp burning before it, until she fancied that she saw shadowy figures standing there, and even that she heard them speak to her. The people in that part of France were very ignorant and superstitious, and they had many ghostly tales to tell about what they had dreamed, and what they saw among the lonely hills when the clouds and the mists were resting on them. So, they easily believed that Joan saw strange sights, and they whispered among themselves that angels and spirits talked to her. At last, Joan told her father that she had one day been surprised by a great unearthly light, and had afterwards heard a solemn voice, which said it was Saint Michael at EMS voice, telling her that she was to go and help the Dauphin. Soon after this, she said, Saint Catherine and Saint Margaret had appeared to her with sparkling crowns upon their heads, and had encouraged her to be virtuous and resolute. These visions had returned sometimes, but the voices very often, and the voices always said, A Joan, thou art appointed by heaven to go and help the Dauphin. A.T.M. She almost always heard them while the chapel bells were ringing. There is no doubt, now, that Joan believed she saw and heard these things. It is very well known that such delusions are a disease which is not by any means uncommon. It is probable enough that there were figures of Saint Michael, and Saint Catherine, and Saint Margaret, in the little chapel, where they would be very likely to have shining crowns upon their heads, and that they first gave Joan the idea of those three personages. She had long been a moping, fanciful girl, and, though she was a very good girl, I dare say she was a little vain, and wishful for notoriety. Her father, something wiser than his neighbours, said, I tell thee, Joan, it is thy fancy. Thou hadst better have a kind husband to take care of thee, girl, and work to employ thy mind. A.T.M. But Joan told him in reply, that she had taken a vow never to have a husband, and that she must go as heaven directed her, to help the Dauphin. It happened, unfortunately for her father at EMS persuasions, and most unfortunately for the poor girl, too, that a party of the Dauphin at EMS enemies found their way into the village while Joan at EMS disorder was at this point, and burnt the chapel, and drove out the inhabitants. The cruelties she saw committed, touched Joan at EMS heart and made her worse. She said that the voices and the figures were now continually with her, that they told her she was the girl who, according to an old prophecy, was to deliver France, and she must go and help the Dauphin, and must remain with him until he should be crowned at Reims, and that she must travel a long way to a certain lord named Baudricourt, who could and would bring her into the Dauphin at EMS presence. As her father still said, I tell thee, Joan, it is thy fancy, A.T.M. she set off to find out this lord, accompanied by an uncle, a poor village wheelwright and cartmaker, who believed in the reality of her visions. They travelled a long way and went on and on, over a rough country, full of the Duke of Burgundy at EMS men, and of all kinds of robbers and marauders, until they came to where this lord was.